Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm Catherine Michalova, and I'm really pleased to be talking about this topic because I think it's a topic that really warrants more consideration in public health and is a growing threat, as I'll address in my presentation. So I'll be looking at the landscape of the wildlife trade and its relevance to public health and what we might do in the future to address the health risk more proactively. I do not have any financial relationships to disclose. So a primer on the international wildlife trade. We're talking about wild, so non-domestic species that are either captive bred or wild caught. And these are live, dead, or wildlife products. And they're intended for use in the pet trade. So, people's pet snakes, people's pet rodents, what have you, food trade. So we sometimes hear about the bushmeat importation, luxury goods such as purses made out of python skin, and medicinal uses. There are two branches of the international wildlife trade, the legal trade. So this includes species carrying appropriate permits and documentations. However, these species are not fully assessed for their zoonotic disease risks. And then there's the illegal trade, which is thought to be really vast in scale as well. So there's an estimated $5 billion to $20 billion a year trade of wildlife illegally, and nearly 90% of countries report illegal trade. So this is really a ubiquitous problem. The detection rate is thought to be quite poor, and this is likely to underestimate the real scale and scope of the international trade. And I should mention that thousands of species have been implicated in the international wildlife trade, and often from countries that are really biodiversity rich, public health infrastructure poor, so those hot spots for disease emergence. So what is the U.S. role in wildlife trade? Well, we're one of the largest consumers of wildlife, and this is primarily for the pet trade. So we're talking about often live animals coming in. We're seeing increasing trends in wildlife trade. So declared shipments alone at 120,000 shipments per year, and a huge increase, 62% in one decade. And just to get a sense of the scale of this, we're talking about 1 billion animals in a five-year span. So this is really easy, for things to go under the radar just because of the large quantity. So what's the relevance to public health? Well, we know that nearly or greater than 60% of human infectious diseases are zoonotic, meaning that they come from wild from animals, and the majority of these are from wildlife. And this is especially the case for emerging infectious diseases, so novel diseases that we've seen, say, in the last 100 years. And bushmeat and global trade are drivers of disease emergence from wildlife. And what is it about this these trade practices that causes, well, there's an opportunity that arises for that emergence and transmission into a human. So this may be through wildlife-human contact or wildlife-domestic animal contact through trade that then is more efficiently transmitted to humans from a domestic animal. So hunting may involve contact with free-ranging wildlife. There may be foodborne infection through bushmeat, and there may be changes in the cycle of pathogenicity and virulence of a pathogen. And the wildlife trade especially involves a lot of crowded, stressful conditions, so animals may be immunocompromised, allowing for more efficient spread of a pathogen. There may be mixing of different species from various locations around the world, leading to pathogen pollution and really novel interactions of species for the first time. And as I said, that close contact opportunity between humans, domestic animals, and wildlife. Now, I'm sorry that this is a bit of a graphic image, but I think I want to make the point that the wildlife trade is really complex. So the supply chain may involve, say, getting an animal from the forest and then bringing it into a market. And then you may have, so here, this was in North Sulawesi earlier this year, this person carrying, a bat in this case, bare hands, butchering it. We have this animal carcass next to it, and this is just a really efficient mixing pot for pathogens. So have we seen examples of disease through international wildlife trade? Well, yes, and we were actually just talking about monkeypox, the emergence in 2003 in the U.S. when African rodents were imported, mixed with prairie dogs in a pet store, and this led to human-to-human transmission. There were 72 human infections in the U.S., fortunately no fatalities, but we know that there is a 10% fatality rate in Africa, so this is a potentially quite dangerous pathogen. And as a result, the CDC banned the importation of African rodents. reptile and amphibian-associated salmonellosis we've continually seen. In 1975, the FDA banned the trade of small turtles. Children would really like to have them as pets. They're under 4 inches, and they would hold them, not wash their hands, sometimes put them into their mouth, and we would see really high cases of salmonellosis each year. So the ban has been incredibly effective. It's thought to have cut down on upwards of 100,000 cases per year, but the illegal trade of amphibians and reptiles is still a source of salmonellosis introduction. Let us not forget HIV-1 came from chimpanzee SIV strain thought to be from bushmeat consumption. So now this global pathogen of concern that, you know, originally it came from wildlife. We've also seen confiscated birds that have been infected with H5N1. Fortunately, these were not associated with any outbreak, but we see that there is the potential for this global spread of serious pathogens through trade. So we do have some regulations of animal imports, but I want to highlight here that U.S. agencies have really differing mandates. So the CDC regulates taxa deemed a risk to public health, and these are bats, non-human primates, and African rodents. USDA emphasizes taxa deemed a risk to the agricultural industry. So not really what we're talking about here, although there are zoonotic disease risks to animal handlers. U.S. Fish and Wildlife mainly focuses on endangered species and those deemed to be injurious to native wildlife through the Lacey Act, and then enforces the international framework CITES, which is concerned with endangered species. NOAA regulates marine species as well. So we see just here four examples of different regulating agencies. And in 2010, the Government Accountability Office issued a report on live animal imports calling for better collaboration among the agencies to precisely reduce the risk of animal-related diseases. We've also seen on the regulatory landscape some proposed laws, such as whitelist, to only allow in species that have very minimal disease risks. But so far, these have not come to fruition. Then internationally, because the wildlife trade is so global, we have some relevant frameworks. So CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, is an intergovernmental organization of 178 countries. The listings are based on conservation threat. So this does severely cut down on the number of species coming in legally, but there's no formal incorporation of disease risks. And then the World Organization for Animal Health is responsible for improving animal health worldwide. And the regulations hold a lot of weight. They're enforced by the World Trade Organization. But so far, there's just voluntary reporting of infection wild species, and there aren't the same strong measures that we have for livestock. So how does this play out when we look at domestic animal importation versus wildlife importation? Well, we know that for livestock and traditional pets, in theory, there's really strict regulation through the OIE and science-based control measures where there are some risks. And then livestock may hold disease-free status. There are often health inspections at holding and production facilities, and animals may carry health certificates and then may be subject to a quarantine period. For wildlife, the majority of species are not regulated, and often the role of wildlife is not known for the majority of human and livestock diseases. So we see there's this really big difference between domestic animal and wildlife importation. So what are some challenges that lead to those real distinct differences? Well, just the quantity of legal and illegal imports per year. We saw that 120 million shipments per year. There are record-keeping challenges, so there's no international database for wildlife trade. And species identification can be quite challenging. In wildlife products, it may not be possible to discern the species without conducting genetic testing. And there's no comprehensive national or international authority. So it's hard to get a sense of the global scale and scope of the trade. So what can we do to better learn and address the potential public health risks? Well, we can begin by identifying pathogens that may be moving via the trade. So these could be known pathogens or novel pathogens. And then we can use this information to inform regulating agencies and potentially guide regulations, enforcement, and best practices. So I'd like to give two examples of that. And the first one is the USAID Emerging Pandemic Threats Predict Program. So this is a collaboration through USAID led by UC Davis with partners from EcoHealth Alliance, Wildlife Conservation Society, Metabiota, and the Smithsonian Institution. And we're working in 20-plus countries to conduct pathogen surveillance in wildlife at their source, so in the source countries, at several different interfaces, many of which are related to traits. So free-ranging wildlife, wildlife that has been hunted, wildlife at markets, and other such interfaces. We can also look at zoonotic disease risks of wildlife and wildlife products coming into the U.S., so things that are being imported and confiscated. The CDC has initiated a study, actually in 2009, with partners from EcoHealth Alliance, Wildlife Conservation Society, Columbia University, and American Museum of Natural History, and recently released a paper that did that reported on identification of retroviruses in bushmeat that was confiscated as it was coming into the U.S. So it's important to give a disclaimer that this does not show direct potential for transmission, you know, zoonotic transmission, but it does show that there's potential for the trade as a conduit to pathogen spread, so it may warrant further look. So we can also conduct zoonotic disease risk analyses, and these are science-based. Inputs are scientific information that we know, such as host species, pathogenicity, virulence information, and morbidity and mortality. And these can employ low-tech approaches, such as qualitative assessments, or use more technologically advanced risk modeling programs. They really benefit from involvement of a wide range of stakeholders, and this helps to assess the true risk based on actual practices in the trade. And that it also enables potential interventions to be more targeted and implementable later on. And one real strength of them is they are useful in generating information even when we don't have a full set of data, and it can help us to identify gaps in our data sets and show where we may need more information, and then it can be iterative when we do have that information. And it's really, you know, the purpose is to regulate based on risk and have a more proactive sense of where the highest risk may be. So an example of that, EcoHealth Alliance has been working with the University of Minnesota to develop a tool that agencies and others may use around wildlife trade. So we've been looking at rodents imported from Latin America. And why rodents? Well, there are no health regulations in rodents other than African rodents. And why Latin America? We needed a smaller scale of import to look at just to pilot the project. So as I said, the objective was to create a tool, and so we started with a four-phase project. And the first was a survey of experts and industry representatives about the scale of the trade of rodents from Latin America, what they perceived as the largest risks. And this helped us to assess whether this was really a meaningful taxa to look at and, you know, what we might want to focus our efforts on. Then we compiled a list of rodent-carried pathogens from the literature and gray literature and some interviews, and then plugged this into a pathway analysis. So looking from point A to B, and point A being the source, the animal, you know, whether it's at a breeding facility or from the wild, and then the end user, so whether for the pet trade or for food consumption. And then we identified where there might be some critical control points for zoonotic disease risk. Then we conducted a qualitative assessment with some further information from experts, and then plugged this into a semi-quantitative assessment that assigned an overall risk score that we could use. So this is still an ongoing project, so unfortunately I don't have specific information about rodents imported into Latin America and their risks, but I will be able to provide more information on this in the future, and I look forward to doing that. So how can we also engage consumers? So they're the ones really driving the demand for wildlife trade. And we know that in the U.S., the pet trade is, you know, where most wildlife coming in is really destined for. So we can start to employ risk communication strategies. And the CDC's Healthy Pets, Healthy People program is a great example of that. And then at EcoHealth Alliance, we have a pet watch program that is intended to help you choose the right pet. So I'd like to give an example of that. An agouti is it's a rodent from Latin America. It's quite cute, so you might say, wow, this is a you know, potentially really good pet for my family. Well, it does emit a very strong odor, so you may not want it for that reason, but there's also another reason why it may not be an ideal pet choice for a household? Well, we see that it's a little challenging to read there, but agoutis may carry leptospirosis or yellow fever, so this could be something really serious to have in your home, and you may want to seek an alternative such as a hamster, which may be safer for your family. So overall recommendations on what we can do to really address the public health risks of the wildlife trade. Well, we can start by conducting targeted surveillance of traded species, whether at the source, in the forest where animals are being harvested, or in confiscated wildlife that are entering our borders. And this can help us assist in early detection of risks. We can also employ science-based risk assessments, which can guide proactive regulatory actions and inform where we should emphasize our concern and our enforcement efforts. And then we can also address upstream consumer demand through risk communication that informs the public and allows them to make healthy pet choices. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much and thank our collaborators, and I'd be happy to take any questions either now or after the session.
About 4 minutes, so
okay.
You want to take questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Billy Correct is on your staff also?
He is. He's my
colleague.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And he's a wildlife veterinarian has been involved in studying the wildlife trade for the past 10, 15 years. And I think it's just on that point, a lot of the people working in these wildlife trade studies are really conservation-oriented, and we're really finding that, wow, there's both a conservation risk to source sustainability and there are public health risks, and we can really take a One Health approach that allows us to address those risks synergistically. Yes, thank you. Yes, that's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. So regarding the data for the rodents from Latin America, there's not that much data, and it is challenging because of that, and that's been a main constraint. We've been looking in the literature, just documentation of pathogens that have been found in rodents in Latin America, talking with rodent experts and, saying, what are you finding that may not be published? But there's still this huge lack of data, and that makes it really challenging to regulate. I think the point of these risk assessments is really to find, okay, what do we know, and then how can we find more information and then plug that in, and what do we not know, what do we need to still learn? Thanks, great question. Thank you. That's a great question. So regarding national and international regulations and the best way forward on that and how long that may take, it's a great question, and I think it is a challenging question, and I think that's why there has been no coordinated strategy yet. Certainly, I think it needs to happen with especially more globalization and the U.S. being one of the main consumers of wildlife. I think, there are a lot of different routes, and I don't think we've found a best way forward yet, but I think it does need to be science-based, because otherwise it will get a lot of negative take from the pet industry. And I mean, pet ownership is a wonderful thing, and we don't want to detract from those benefits. We just want to offer healthy pet choices and make sure the public health risks are minimized from wildlife trade. I think your question is, I would take any guidance from you and anyone in this room on how we might do that, because I think it's a challenging area that we do need to be looking at. Thank you.
Oh,
okay, thank you so much. Thanks.